You're listening to This is Yoga Therapy. I'm your host, Michelle Lawrence, and I've had the opportunity to interview many of those who are making a difference at the intersections of yoga and health. And I'm here to share with you their stories and conversations. Thanks for listening. In today's episode, I interviewed Brett Larkin. Brett is the founder of her award-winning YouTube channel, The Uplifted Online Yoga Teacher Trainings. She's a successful entrepreneur and sought-after online business consultant. And today, Brett will share more about herself with you all, and she'll also talk about her book, Yoga Life. And it's so great to meet you, Brett, and have you on the podcast today.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm so happy to be here. I have tea. I'm excited to chat yoga. So this is my favorite thing to do.
Wonderful. So let's just start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself, your personal journey with yoga, and how it led you to overcoming anxiety and building this successful business that you have.
Well, first of all, I always like to say that I'm someone who never thought I could make a living teaching yoga. I thought if I committed to teach yoga, that would mean I'd be destitute and poor forever. So I had all the money blocks, all the self-limiting beliefs. I was in denial with myself about wanting to teach yoga. I first found yoga towards the end of college. And I had a friend at the time who was really into meditation. And I had grown up as a dancer. I considered myself very hardcore. I was doing a lot of Pilates at the time. So he kept telling me, you know, why don't you meditate with me? And I kind of would do it, mainly just because I had a crush on him. I didn't really like it that much. But then he kept pushing me. He said, you know, you should try yoga. You know, you have this dance background with the Pilates. You know, I really think you'd like it. And I point blank said to him, why would I do that? Yoga's for wimps. That was verbatim my response. I mean, it was just unfathomable to me that a hardcore dancer such as myself would consider such a thing. But I decided I'd try it if I could go to only the most intense kind of yoga class. So that led me to what was then called Bikram Hot Yoga. And I found myself competing in the mirror with other spandex clad people trying to get my leg higher than everyone else. And that's how it started for me. So even though, and I talk about this in my book, like that hot yoga was actually probably the worst style of yoga I could have possibly chosen if my goal was to balance myself. But the fact that I was even just moving my body and kind of gaining an awareness of my thoughts, and it was burning off this layer of anxiety and tension that I didn't even know I had been living with, and I was hooked. And then from the hot yoga, I decided to try all the styles, and it became this really passionate love story.
That's awesome. And I really appreciate that you started that way because you are really successful. And I think for so many yoga teachers that we kind of feel like we're destined to never really making it. So I appreciate you saying that that's part of your history and your background too. And you've obviously broken through that. So let's kind of talk a little bit about your relationship with yoga now and, you know, what you offer to the people that you work with too. And I guess maybe we can say, like, how does your approach to yoga now provide a solution for those who feel disconnected from conventional yoga classes?
It's interesting. I think one of the things that was very strange about me was that I was always really interested in yoga online from a very early point. And it's important to note that this was mainly because I was too afraid to teach at a studio or apply to teach at a studio. That felt very, very intimidating to me. However, because I had this dancer background, I always used to audition to go to these dance programs in the summer, or it was very common that you'd have to like film a audition video to get into certain dance programs. So when I had moved from New York, which is where I did all my teacher training, and I ended up in San Francisco at the company I was working with, I was really missing my New York teachers. And I decided to create a sequence that I loved and that I wanted to remember, kind of like I love choreography, right? I was like, I really want to remember this. And that's how I ended up filming it and putting it on YouTube. Again, at this time, that felt like an outlet for me because I still wasn't owning the yoga teacher identity. I was too scared to go to like a San Francisco studio and apply for a job. So it felt like a small step that I could take in spite of my fear. And so it's interesting because that was 2012 and I thought I was late. I was like, oh, I'm late to YouTube. Like I should have started this way sooner. But it turns out that I was actually in this still very early wave of adopters and bringing yoga online. So it's interesting because the YouTube channel from there grew and grew. And then, you know, I had a yoga membership site and a yoga mobile app back when that was still very weird. I mean, I'd honestly not really tell other yoga teachers about what I was doing because they thought it was so strange. And then I put yoga teacher training online in 2015, 5 years before COVID. So that's kind of the online has always been my passion. I love making videos. I love conducting our teacher training calls like on Zoom. And I was doing that before people knew what Zoom was. We had an entire, it's so funny, orientation week that was just about how to use Zoom that was built into all our trainings back in 2015. And obviously in 2020, we didn't need that orientation week anymore because it was just commonplace. The things that in terms of the actual yoga methodology that I'm really passionate about is that the pose is not the goal. You know, it's the awareness in the pose that is the goal. And I think for the right student for me is very attracted to that, right? It's like time to stop shoehorning ourselves into postures and figuring out how these postures feel nourishing on us. And it's not about achieving some super fancy complex back bend or getting your leg higher than the person in the mirror, ironically where I started, right? It's not about that. It's about how aware am I of my own response and programming as I go into something like a pyramid pose. Am I pushing myself past the point of comfort? Am I pushing myself too hard? Or am I not efforting enough? Am I feeling my breath in the body? Am I thinking about what to cook for dinner? Or am I really in the here and now? So that presence in the posture, and I define yoga in my book as awareness. Like yoga is awareness. And the breath obviously being the bridge that gets us there. But that's something I'm very passionate about. I'm also really passionate about the fascial system. Fascia is the interconnective tissue that your cells, your organs, everything in your body is living in. It's not addressed in many teacher trainings, but it's so essential to understanding how we're all unique as an individual. There's also science now showing that consciousness and emotions are residing in the fascia. These are all things I'm sure you know so much about as well. So I could go on and on, but I love the philosophy of yoga too, and taking yoga off the mat. Right? Like the real yoga is invisible. It's what we're doing in our conversations with our partners, in our conversations with our children. If you have children, that's why I call my book Yoga Life, because it's this reframe of instead of just seeing yoga as this thing you do, it's seeing your whole life as a yoga studio.
So cool. I want to go back to your sort of first mover, early adopter of online yoga, because I find it so fascinating. And it's been successful for you, right? The fact that you were there before everyone else. But I guess my question really is, and I love Zoom yoga. I love online yoga as well. Why do you think you love it so much?
I think I love it so much because I've always loved filmmaking. Like when I look back as a kid, I love sharing this. This is like dates me, right? But I grew up with like the era of those little troll dolls. I don't know if other people remember those, but they're like these little dolls and their hair is like a neon color and it sticks straight up. And I remember even at age 8 and 9, I was making these videos. My dad was great. He really instilled this entrepreneurial spirit in me. So when I expressed an interest in something, he really helped me take it all the way. So I was making these little videos with my troll dolls when I was like 8 and 9 and, you know, trying to figure out how to edit. So I definitely don't think online yoga or an online yoga business is the right fit for everyone. But for me, you know, YouTube is like a match made in heaven. It's like the two things I love the most. It's like filmmaking and yoga. And I think I love creating an experience for someone. And I think for a different yoga teacher, that experience, and I have friends who do this majestically, right? They have a retreat and everything from the like the gift bag and the workbook you get maybe at the start of the retreat, and the theme is so beautifully curated. But I feel I'm doing the same thing. It's just that curation process is like how beautiful the manual is that I ship you, how beautiful the emails are and the syllabus and how well everything is organized and the fun checklists and way we make it really easy to move through the material. The experiences, maybe the soundtrack, the music. I mean, I'm making my own original music to score my own videos now because I want the music to change with the exercises in a very particular way that I couldn't get from stock music, which I've been using for years. So now I'm literally authoring my own, commissioning my own music, because that's what makes an experience really special. So it's definitely not right for everyone. But I think, you know, yoga teachers listening to this, it's like, what are your other passions beyond yoga? And how can you weave that magic in? Because the magic of the practice is going to come through you as a whole being, all facets of you, right? So a lot of times the thing we're most ashamed of, like I thought I was too nerdy and too techie kind of to be a real yoga teacher to be taken seriously. But it turns out that I was actually able to leverage some of that tech expertise to getting online and starting these trainings online way before anyone else even saw the opportunity.
Yeah, that's really cool. It sounds like, you know, such a beautiful marriage of your creative forces with what you love, right? And putting that into just a whole package of who you are and what you do. And I also wonder too, if like meeting people in their own homes and in their everyday lives is an aspect of it for you as well, in terms of the accessibility piece or the piece of like really embracing yoga in your whole life. I know that's a big part of it for me, right? How like the online aspect, the online yoga, the Zoom, it makes things so much more accessible and it invites in more people than could ever have really been able to take trainings before.
I agree. I mean, I've had so many people in my trainings who are flight attendants or nurses, or, you know, they could never do the traditional online training format. I love it when we have moms with babies in their lap yeah. on the live calls. Makes me so happy. And we've had a lot of people take trainings who have, I'm blanking on the name of the condition, but people who are actually afraid to go outside or leave their home. So it's really magical that the technology exists for us to be able to do this and for those people to also get connected to each other. I think that's why I like running my trainings in a cohort model where people are with the same group from the start to the finish. Obviously, there's a home study portion, there's a mobile app, there's a book you get shipped, the manual you get shipped. But for the actual live hours, where you're with the same people. So those relationships form. Because I think if you're just studying alone, it's not the same, right? It's in the discussing the yogic concepts, right? Or discussing the philosophy with others or seeing what the poses look like on other people's bodies that I think the magic really happens.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, I'm with you. So let's talk a little bit about Kundalini yoga. I certainly have experience with it, although that's not my lineage nor what I teach, but I truly love Kundalini yoga and have been through trainings myself. So for those folks who may not be as familiar, maybe you can speak to ways in which Kundalini yoga differs from other styles and why it might be especially relevant today.
This is one of my favorite things to talk about. First of all, I want to preface by saying that as yoga teachers, I think we're very guilty of wanting to divide up the styles, right? It's kind of like when you go to medical school, you dissect bodies. I think as we go through our teaching careers, right, we specialize in different quote unquote styles. But the reality is when we look big picture, it's like all these styles have so much more in common than they do differences. And I think something I do a lot, whether it's on YouTube or in the trainings, is like weaving a lot of different styles in and together. And I know that's also controversial, but I found it works really well for me. And I speak to that directly in the book as well. In terms of Kundalini specifically, if we're going to say like, how is Kundalini different from, let's say, a Hatha Vinyasa type of practice? There's so many things we can talk about. Kundalini yoga is often called the yoga of awareness because it's designed to poke and provoke you a little bit. So it's showing you how you habitually react to stress. Now, sometimes you feel that way in a Hatha Vinyasa class too. Like if you're in a chair pose, you're uncomfortable, you want to get out of the chair pose, you know? And so there's sort of an inner witnessing of that strain that's happening. But in Kundalini, that is really like what we are tapping into full force, right? It's like I describe it as like a laboratory that you're putting yourself into, holding your arms out for a very long amount of time or doing more rigorous breathwork techniques to see how do I react when there's pressure, tension, and friction on my body. Kundalini yoga is also called the science of angles and triangles, meaning that while in Hatha and Vinyasa yoga, we often flow through postures, thinking of a classical sun salutation, for example, in Kundalini yoga, we're working more with the subtle body than the physical body. So I always like to differentiate what we're doing in yoga with the physical body, which is like the meat suit, which is associated for me more with Hatha Vinyasa yoga and the eight limbs, right? So in Hatha Vinyasa yoga, it's like we're preparing the body to sit in meditation. So my son's kindergarten teacher uses the same technique, right? She has all the kids come into the class and they do the wiggles. And I think they even do a little dance video. And then she has them sit and do their work. It's like the yogis figured this out too. They were like, oh, if we do all this asana, right? All these alphabet of postures, not only does it strengthen our spine so we can sit in stillness longer, but it kind of works some of that initial energy out of the body so that then we can sit and move on to pratyahara and dharana and all the other stages of the eight limbs. Kundalini yoga, in contrast, isn't so much working with the eight limb system in that way. It's kind of fusing mantra, meditation, and movement all together. So you actually meditate between each Kundalini yoga posture. And the postures, instead of being more flowing, are more rhythmic. And instead of being focused on the meat suit, the physical body, they're more focused on the energy body. So it's very common in Kundalini yoga to also see kriyas for anger, for example, like working with the emotions, or also working more on the organs and the glands, right, specifically. And then the science of angles and triangles is like it often works with holding positions for a long time. I think of like the arms up at 45 degrees in like an ego eradicator, or the legs up at 45 degrees in a stretch pose, or 30 degrees if you're strong in your
abdominals. Stretch pose is not the best name for that, by the way.
Yes, I know. There's a lot of Kundalini poses where you're like, how did this get named this? And then, you know, Kundalini uses a lot of music. They have what's called the Guru Shabad, which is the sound current, right? The sacred sound. So they say sound is a sacred teacher. So the mantras, the chanting, the meditating between every single pose is quite different from Hatha Vinyasa. They're both beautiful lineages. I love them both. But does that paint a picture a little bit about how they're different?
Yeah, I think that's great. And for folks who may have had their interest piqued right there, they can go check it out and try it for themselves too, right?
Absolutely. One of the things I've really tried to focus on is making Kundalini yoga more accessible and approachable. So there's lots of free videos on YouTube. And of course, I have a Kundalini course and teacher training as well. But I know for me, I had a very adverse reaction to Kundalini yoga when I first experienced it, a very adverse reaction. I wasn't given from the teacher the context of what Kundalini was about and that it was kind of designed to poke and provoke me a little bit. And I remember I just had a really negative experience. I didn't go back for 2.5 years. I had a terrible headache after that class. And, you know, you really need to know yourself and know your dominant dosha, which ties into some of the material I write about in the book, because Kundalini yoga, if practiced in the right amount, pending your constitution, can be transformational, but it can also take you out of balance if you have high vata, like if you're air dominant, for example. So even within the yoga styles, I think personalization is such a critical element. You know, you're always going to be attracted to what you don't need. Like me, you know, 20 years ago being attracted to Bikram yoga because I had high pitta. And so, you know, like attracts like. It was, of course, I was like, let's do the most fiery class I can find. While that was better than no yoga at all, it definitely was not the yoga that was most balancing to my constitution.
Some really good nuggets right in there that we're going to, I think, unpack a little bit more here in a moment. I guess maybe let's talk about your book first next. You've mentioned it a couple times. So let's talk about that. And then let's talk about this whole personalization thing a bit too, because that's very much in line with what we do as yoga therapists. So your book, so it's called Yoga Life, Habits, Poses, and Breathwork to Channel Joy Amidst the Chaos. So what inspired you to write it, and how does it challenge traditional views of yoga?
I wrote this book in the most challenging year of my life, which was, well, let's reframe. I didn't write it, but I got the idea to write it in the most challenging year of my life. So what ended up happening is I lost my father to cancer. I was his sole care provider and had my first child within 12 months of each other. So when I say I was my dad's sole care provider, I really was. I was an only child. My parents were divorced. He never remarried. So in my home, I had my dad on hospice care in one bedroom across from my bedroom. And in the other bedroom across from my bedroom, I had my newborn. And the process of becoming a mom and then his full-time caretaker. And I remember the business was expanding a lot that year as well. I was drowning, Michelle. Like I couldn't. I felt like such a fraud and such a failure because I couldn't practice yoga the way I used to anymore. I didn't have time. I didn't have energy. I was fighting on the phone with the insurance companies for my dad's care, keeping my newborn from, you know, rolling off the couch. It was just chaos. And I remember looking at all the yogic texts that I loved and just thinking, like, can any of these texts help me right now? You know, I don't have very much time to practice. I can't go to studios anymore. I had stopped teaching in studios at that point once my son was born. Everything I saw was about achieving enlightenment, right? Achieving samadhi. And I said, well, I just need to survive till bedtime. What can help me in this philosophy? So I really honed in on Sutra 2.1 from the Yoga Sutras, which is the Kriya Yoga Sutra and kind of describes yoga in action. So I talk about that in the book, you know, how I integrated Svadhyaya, Ishvari Pranidhana, and Tapas and kind of remolded those words to help me in the chaos. And how I used to practice during that time was that I would set a timer on my phone for how long I had to practice each day. And sometimes it was 7 minutes. On a good day, it was 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. You know, some days it was 13 minutes. But, you know, it's kind of like necessity is the mother of invention. Because I was so time strapped, I just started to go really deeply inward. So that's how I'd start my practice. I'd be like, how do I feel? What do I want? Like, how can I nourish myself in this little slice of time that I have? And then I really threw out the rules. Like, up until that point, I was practicing Kundalini yoga from a very strict traditional viewpoint. Meaning, like, I had to wear white, I had to get up at a certain time, I had to chant certain mantras, right? Like, I started to sort of let all that go just out of sheer desperation and doing things that seemed a little weird, like combining Kundalini yoga and yin yoga, or just doing a couple of vinyasa poses and then switching to breath work and then ending with some Kundalini. But I was really introspecting, and luckily I was deep into my yoga journey enough that I felt like I knew what I needed. And I'll never forget, there was just this one day where I sort of did this really hyper-personalized practice that was designed to nourish me. And I remember feeling so good, like, wow, that was an amazing practice. That yoga glow that you get at the end of a, you know, 60, 75 minute class. And then I thought, oh crap, my timer hasn't gone off yet. My phone must have died, because I think I had set it for 20 minutes that day. And I look at the timer and it's 18 minutes. I'd gotten myself into this really incredible state in 18 minutes. And then I just remembered thinking, like, yeah, wow, how did I do that? I don't have time right now, but I'm going to figure out how I did this. And then I'm going to teach it to other people, because I just couldn't believe how good I felt in such a short amount of time. So that's when the idea for the book was born. I didn't have time to write the book for many years, or to figure out even what happened, because at the time I couldn't have told you what happened. Right. But aside from kind of dissecting the Kriya Yoga Sutra and how to live yoga off the mat, just embodying those three principles from Sutra 2.1, which has really worked for me, like really worked for me. It got me through that hard year. After COVID, it was another hard year. I had a second child. I had some hard times in my marriage. Like, every time embodying those three principles has resolved everything. So I'm a very firm believer. So that's the first part of the book. And then the second part is helping you design a 20-minute personalized routine based on your constitution. So we start with Ayurveda. We say, are you earth, air, fire dominant? And then the book guides you through creating a very personalized, nourishing 20-minute routine based on your constitution. And then the end of the book, which is my favorite, is like, okay, you don't have 20 minutes. Your baby's not sleeping through the night. You woke up late. The ritual, the way we assemble it, is modular. So it's like, okay, you only have 5 minutes and you have high vata, like, just do this one section of your ritual, or just do this pose, right? Or the house is clean and you have 60 minutes and a babysitter, like, here's how you'd expand this. But a lot of it's about how to contract it. And then I offer all these, what I call yoga habits, which are little ways to, like, sprinkle yoga throughout your day to day, even if it's just here and there between other activities.
That sounds great. I'm curious, you know, you're talking about identifying your constitution or your dosha, and then there's your imbalances too. So I'm curious if you get into that, because I think what so many of us are facing now is we may know what our constitution is if we've studied this or if we've been informed through a book like yours, but like, so many people have vata imbalances right now. And so even though pitta is my primary dosha, I'm in my vata time of life, life itself is so vata disturbing, like those are the practices I need. So it's kind of like really meeting yourself where you are. And I'm wondering if you can speak to that in the context of how the book guides you as well.
Absolutely. It uses the principle. I mean, Ayurveda is the science of opposites, right? So that's the key phrase, is cultivate the opposite. So if you have high air or high fire, you need more earth. If you have high earth, you need more air and more fire. So what's interesting about the word dosha is if we actually look at the etymology of the Sanskrit, it actually means like dosha means like fault line or that which can cause problems. And that's because your dominant dosha, whatever that is for you, is the one that's most likely to skew out of balance. Like my pitta choosing hot yoga. It's like you don't want your dominant dosha to pick your yoga practice, right? So I talk about potentially a great way to design your personal practice is to indulge in what you want and then transition to what you need. So for example, if I have high pitta, what I need are poses close to the ground. What I need is perhaps a full complete breath or extending the exhalations. I need more of that grounding earth element. But if I'm like just finished work and I'm like in go, 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 hustle crazy mode, it's going to be too hard for me to cultivate the opposite and like do restorative yoga on the floor. So it might help to indulge in what I want. So maybe I do 3 or 4 sun salutations with some chaturangas and I kind of get that out of my system, but then transition to what I need, which could be yin or a long held like Paschimottanasana on the floor. So I love using cultivate the opposite, of course, but often we have to indulge in what we want and transition to what we need at a macro level in our personal practice. But you can even do this within each asana itself. And I have illustrations of this in the book. Like for example, I talk a lot about part of this svadhyaya, this self-awareness, this introspection, is knowing, like, are you someone who is a sensation junkie? That's very much me as an ex-dancer. Or are you not as attuned to feeling more? Like, you'd rather focus more on strength, for example. So knowing where you fall in that spectrum can also help you cultivate the opposite. So for me, like, even in a pose, like a lunge, I indulge in what I want for a moment, which is like, just letting my hips and my pelvis drop towards the floor and feeling that like juicy stretch, right? Like, oh, sensation junkie, love it. And then even within that posture, boom, because I have awareness, I then transition to what I need. Okay, indulge, 2 breaths, juicy stretch. Okay, now Brett, let's indulge in what you need. Let's cultivate the opposite. I have a lot of range of motion, so I need to focus on strength. I need to focus on stability. That means I need to pull my pelvic floor up and in. That means I need to hug my inner thighs together. That means I need to root more with my front foot. Maybe it means I take my hands to my hips instead of reaching them up over my head, because anytime we take the arms up, that's going to increase vata, right? I don't necessarily need that. So does that give some examples or tastes of kind of what this looks like in practice?
Oh, yeah, totally. And it's so relatable as a yoga therapist. And I'm sure many of the yoga therapists who are listening, I mean, this is exactly how we guide our clients, right? And maybe we use the concept of the gunas more than the doshas, really the basics of those elements or qualities of nature, and then balancing the opposites, but always kind of meeting the person where they are. And I'm hearing you say all of this. So it's very resonant. And meeting them where they are in that moment, maybe that looks like giving them what they want so that you can get to what they need. And that's how we work too. And I just see a lot of parallels there too. And it's great that your book really focuses on personalizing yoga. And I think what you're sharing here is like, this is how we can optimize, right? This is how we can find maximum benefit, stress release, maybe even in, I hate to say like the shortest amount of time, right? Because if we want to go deeper in our practices, it's really beautiful to spend more time there. But I think consistency is key. And if that means just a little bit of time each day, that's really important.
An analogy I love to use here is about thinking of your nervous system regulation like money in the bank. So let me explain what that means a little bit. But I mean, here, I don't think we need to convince people, but a lot of times I go on podcasts where people maybe just think it's not worth it to do like 5 minutes of yoga or 2 minutes of breath work. And when I hear that, and even a lot of yoga teachers, I feel like have this block where we're like, oh, if it's not going to be in yoga clothes and at least 45 minutes, like it's just not worth doing. So that's something that I love to talk about and kind of dismantle, because to use the savings account analogy, like I think we could all agree that if I went to my local bank in my neighborhood and opened a savings account and put a little bit of money in it each day, over the course of years, that money would grow because it's being accrued, and maybe even a compound interest effect would take place where it would just grow in that savings account. So when we start to think of nervous system regulation, like any attempt to witness the breath or deepen the breath is worthwhile, and it's like money going into that nervous system bank, it makes you much more excited to do the yoga habits or kind of like mini practices throughout your day. Now, are they as good or nourishing as a 60-minute class where you have your phone off and no kids around you? Like, no, that's wonderful. Like, do that if you can. But there's seasons of each of our lives, whether it's dying parents or, you know, welcoming a new life into the world, or, you know, an incredibly stressful transition or move or work situation, where we need to be flexible. And all the little bits really do add up. And I think what I kind of found is like, oh, if I just do a little bit, even if it's just a short practice, or even if it's just then throughout the day, like here and there between other things, all the yoga habits, like, you know, taking little stretch breaks or deepening my breath, or there's tons of ideas in the book. But if I do that, it's like dropping a little bit of money into that bank every single day. And then if I personalize it, like I know what breathing technique is incredibly balancing for my dominant dosha, and I prioritize doing that, even if it's just for a couple minutes. And the garage is one of my favorite places to practice after maybe I drop my kids off somewhere. I know when I get in the house, like I'll want to do stuff, right? So I just pause in the garage. For me, it's a kind of in-between space, and just do 3 minutes. For me, it's Sitali Pranayam. I love Sitali because it's really cooling for my fire, which tends to get out of control easily. So it's like, if you know how to then personalize, instead of that deposit in the bank being like 10 cents, it becomes 50 cents. It becomes a dollar. The more that you're able to personalize, the more that nervous system accrual kind of adds up, and that every little bit counts. And we see this personalization everywhere. I get ads for personalized shampoo. I don't know if anyone else gets those. Personalized medicine is like the future. Personalized vitamins. And yet so many people think yoga is still going to like similar to an aerobics class, flowing on the same breath, doing the same movement in the same way as everyone else. And in the second chapter, I talk about the history of yoga and how it came west, and how actually if we look backwards, like yoga was always meant to be personalized.
Yeah. You're definitely speaking my language, so I really appreciate it. And I'd love to kind of close kind of taking that and having you share more about you and your personal practice. This is something we put a big emphasis on in our training programs at Inner Peace Yoga Therapy, because we really feel like you need to do your own work. You need to have your own sadhana, your own personal practice, if you want to work with others and hold that space, because it really sets the stage for all that's to come. So I'm sure you have your own personal practices as well. You've already spoken to a few of them. Can you share more what that looks like on a day-to-day basis for you?
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, Michelle, again, like I just want to acknowledge you as well, because it seems like there's so much similarities in what we're doing, and whether you want to put the lens of awareness on yourself and the poses you're doing through Ayurveda, like I do in my book, or through the gunas, which you talked about, which I'd love to, you know, how beautiful, or the chakras, you know, many people like that. It's like we have all these different lenses. So it's like finding what makes sense to you and what resonates. My personal practice is, well, I went through a period when I first got really into Kundalini yoga of doing 40-day practices. So if people don't know what that is, in Kundalini, there's this tradition of a 40-day sadhana where you do the same practice every day for 40 days in a row. And if you miss a day, you have to start at zero. So back when I was not as good at, when I had more time, right? And I wasn't as good at being flexible with myself, let's say, I did a lot of those, but I think that has a lot of value. I have a course on 40-day Kriya in the Kundalini courses, like how to do it, how to pick it, all those things. What if you're on your period? You know, I've gotten all the questions over 10 years. But in retrospect, I'm really glad that I did do that. And I think it's worth everyone doing something like that. It doesn't have to be Kundalini yoga, but like a very regimented, a little bit stricter practice for 40 days. Because the whatever practice you're doing ends up serving as a mirror to your own habits and your own responses. So at the beginning, you're into it and then you're bored of it. And then like you go through this whole process. So I think there's a lot of value in doing that once if you're listening and you've never done a 40-day practice. And it could be anything, right? I think I also have like a 40-day nidra thing. So you could, I'm sure, do it with a practice that you already have access to. But why I mention that is because it's interesting for me now. I'm very responsive with what I choose to practice each day. So it's very different day to day because I'm so in tune with my body and what I need. But I notice when I'm really stressed or I notice myself going into old habits, old patterning, I go back to one of those 40-day kriyas that I did years ago because they're kind of just like soulmates. They become a soulmate, you know, it becomes a devotional thing. And it's kind of like a big rock that I'm able to put in my sanity jar, let's say. So I was even talking about this on social media a couple of weeks ago. Like I felt myself feeling a little out of sorts and I was able to go back to one of my key 40-day practices and I really felt it adjust my energy. It was just so nice to have that to come back to. So for those who are interested in Kundalini, or you could do this with Hatha Vinyasa too, I always like to have kind of three default practices at any given time, one that's challenging me. So like if I feel strong, like I know it's going to poke, provoke me a little bit, expand my nervous system capacity, let's say, like we're playing more in sympathetic. So that would be one practice. One that's just really feels great. Like it's not too triggering, let's say, but it's not easy either. And then the third, just being like the routine that you'd go to baby yourself, right? When you are exhausted. And so, of course, the book has like a whole framework for how to put together a personalized practice. And I didn't add this to the book because it would have gotten too complicated. But like once you've done that or figured out or created a personal routine, you can then kind of do those different versions of it, right? Like here's the really easeful version for days I'm tired. Here's the really more challenging version for the days I feel strong. And I feel like if you pre-plan kind of all of this, then when you're tired, you're not as tempted to skip your practice, right? Because you're like, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to do that routine that babies me and makes me feel so good. I also really like tuning in at bedtime. I think bedtime is a great time to think about what you want to practice tomorrow. So even just putting your hands on your body in bed, how do I feel? What do I want? A lot of times, even going to bed, I'm getting inklings of like, you know, I really need like a big breathwork practice tomorrow. Or I really need a longer practice. For me, a lot of times that happens on like a Sunday, let's say. So I'm very much looking inward and then designing what would be nourishing, but having that foundation of some practices that you've really mastered that you know intimately, I think is incredibly valuable.
That's great. Yeah. Thank you so much, Brad. It was really a joy to speak with you today, to learn from you, to share about you to our listeners. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about who we are and what we do, visit us at innerpeaceyogatherapy.com.